do you start an office, right? Assuming you haven't done it before, you probably don't have a playbook. And there's very, very little information out there on how to start an office, really, especially a successful engineering office.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Brian Delahunty. Brian is the head of reliability at Stripe. He was also the site lead who helped them open and hire for their first Seattle office. Throughout this process, he talked to leaders at over a dozen companies like Airbnb and Pinterest who had led their own HQ2 second site office effort. From those conversations, he learned what worked and what didn't, and then he learned from his own experience. Today, he's sharing those lessons with us. The trend today is companies are starting their second headquarters or their second office earlier and earlier in their life cycle. With the cost of hiring and living in San Francisco and New York and some of their high-cost cities, it's making more and more sense to open that earlier and earlier. It also gives you a huge advantage in hiring since you have two pools of talent to draw from. There are not a lot of people in the world that have more expertise on opening that second office than Brian, and I'm really excited to share those with the world. And now, here's my conversation with Brian Delahunty from Stripe. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thank you for having me.
What is the biggest inflection point in your career that got you to where you are today?
I think getting let go from the company before I joined Stripe was a really, really big inflection point. Yeah, I was looking to do something different, and I actually worked in the payments industry a little bit, and they decided that, you know, they wanted to kind of restructure the company, and I got let go, and it kind of gave me the space to think about what I wanted to do next and whether or not I wanted to stay, you know, really deep in the management track or go back to be an individual contributor. And I was kind of in this management role where I spanned both management and IC, you know, kind of one of those roles where you're neither a full manager nor a tech lead or nor an IC.
That's a hard role.
It definitely is quite challenging. And then it gave me the opportunity to really think about what was important to me. And around the same time, I became aware that Stripe was interested in opening an office in Seattle. I think I know it's quite close to where I am now chronologically, but it probably was the biggest change for me in terms of knowing what makes me happy and engaged in my job and what where I can have most impact.
And what was that Venn diagram overlap between what makes you engaged and what brought you and attracted you to Stripe?
Yeah, it's a well-timed question because I recently changed role and I was going through the same kind of set of questions for myself about what I want to do next. There's certain things that I'm getting more comfortable with saying, like things that I feel that I'm good at. This is like a really hard thing for people to do, I think, in general. But there's certain things that I know that I don't feel very happy when I'm doing, mainly because I'm probably just not very good at them. And then there's a set of things that I feel a lot of joy and happiness and just like just a lot of energy from work when I'm doing them. And what I find I have most joy in is when I'm building things from the ground up and the things, you know, building technology and software is one thing, but the things that I realized that I enjoy building the most are organizations and teams, taking kind of the more people aspect problems of software teams and companies in general and actually going from either nothing to something or something that's maybe not quite working today to something better. And really, it's kind of interesting technical challenges, interesting technical problems. But the main thing for me is like really challenging organizational and management problems and how do we actually go from, you know, zero to nothing or something working to nothing.
That makes sense.
Or something working to something working better. Sorry.
Yeah. So you like going zero to one on orgs. That makes a lot of sense. So you you did that for Stripe's office in Seattle. Is that right?
Yeah. So Stripe had a few kind of employees. We're a very remote friendly company. We had a number of employees that, you know, they worked from their treehouse or their coffee shop or their bunker or whatever it is in Seattle at the time. I think there was four people. Actually, some of our executive team or our general counsel was based in Seattle and worked remotely from Seattle and traveled up and down. But they made a decision to open an office and I was the first hire. And I kind of took a leap of faith, to be honest, because it's kind of, you know, it's hard when you do that to know, are they truly invested in building this? You know, is this going to be some office where they're just, you know, projects go to die, or it's like only ever to V2s? So that's kind of what I did. I kind of came in as employee zero, if you will, or employee one in the Seattle office, and went from there.
So it seems like companies are opening second offices quicker and quicker. That's a trend that seems to be accelerating. So if someone's out here is considering being employees here at a new office, what advice do you have to make them more successful?
Yeah, I actually I have a lot of thoughts here. So I actually worked at a different Bay Area company who had a Seattle office for a while. And I think one of the things I didn't do enough of is ask the question of why they had that office. Did they have the office purely because they felt that there was people there that they could hire, or did they have the office for like a longer term goal or vision? Like, was it opportunistic, or was it well thought out and intentional? And I really think you need to understand the intentionality, or like, why is this office becoming a thing? What is going to be there? What is the long term growth plans for it? Because some company kind of look at, you know, spinning up an office purely for opportunistic purposes. They find an employee who's great that they want to build a team around, but there's no long-term plan around how to build a successful office, a successful set of organizations or organization. They don't think through, you know, how is this going to work in the 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year timeframe. So the questions I would ask are really kind of open-ended questions around, what are you trying to achieve here? Why are you doing this? What kind of a analysis process did you go into when you were choosing a site? You know, did you think about this and this and this, right? And these different this things are like long-term growth, depth of market, what functions are going to be in the office? What are your true motivations? I mean, similar to questions you should ask somebody if they're moving from an individual contributor to a manager, what are your motivations for doing this, and why do you think this is important?
So it sounds like maybe opportunistic motivations might be less interesting to you, or less grounded compared to more long-term motivations.
I think the reality of building, you know, enduring, that kind of enduring greatness, if you will, or just any enduring organization at any point, is longer-term thinking, right? Not just reacting and just not just being like super reactive things, but being proactive about the future and what you're going to do there. So I don't think, you know, opportunistic hiring is necessarily a bad thing. You know, Stripe again has a huge percentage of our organization, our engineering org in particular, who are quite you know, disconnected from offices. They are pure remote, and we conceptually have created what we call the logistically created the remote hub, where we have, you know, a lot of our engineers are pure remote. And I think absolutely perfect to do opportunistic hiring, find people who are great. I think it's a little bit different if you want to build an entire office around an individual that was opportunistically hired, right? You know, what are the expectations for that individual? You're putting a lot of weight on them, right? And also, you're not actually being intentional about why you're opening this office. Maybe your intention is open it around a person, but one individual does not make an office. So I'm not against opportunistic hiring at all. I think it is just not best to build an office around opportunistic hiring.
So step one is figure out the why for the office. What's the plan? You know, what are we here for? Is it opportunistic, or is there something more? And then what do we want to do to make sure we're successful?
Yeah, there's a lot of things before you get to the office, right? You need to understand, you know, how many functions you want to have there. I think one of the very common patterns that I've noticed, especially, you know, I personally worked at a Bay Area company. I know this is happening from companies that are based all over the country and the world, but I see it a lot with Bay Area companies where they open, you know, engineering offices and engineering centers, right? Stripe, we took a very different approach. We did not want Stripe Seattle to be engineering only. So I think one of the things you need to think about is, longer term, what business functions, what jobs, what roles do you want to have in this particular office, right? So then what makes an office is not just a bunch of engineers somewhere else. It's many other functions as well that work with engineering, that partner with engineering, and then other support functions for the office itself. And you need to think through, is this market that you're going into, can you hire those people as well? What is the length of time? What is the real estate cost? I mean, at the end of the day, most of these you know, decisions will come down to, you know, a budget sheet somewhere, right? Or a balance sheet somewhere. And you need to actually understand the cost, not just of the initial beginning, but the long-term growth. I think you also need to understand recruiting from a little bit of a different lens. If this is going to be a small office, like, you know, maybe a local office or a regional office or a hub office, depending on how you want to kind of think about the different shapes and sizes of offices, that will then have a direct impact on your hiring. So I think a lot of decisions have to be kind of thought through ahead of time. And there's one word that I will use over and over again around this, and that's just being intentional. You really do need to think through these things, right? And you need to think through what you want the culture to be like in that office. You need to think through, you know, what the expectations of engineers are in that particular market. You know, will they be able to solve the problems you actually want, right? I think people look around, they look like New York and Austin and you know, Seattle and the Bay Area, and there's like, oh, there's lots of engineers there, but they may not be the type of engineer that you need at your particular company, and they also might be a lot more expensive than you think. So I think there's we could spend hours talking about all the ahead of time questions that you should be asking yourself before you even land on a particular market, and then or city or geography to move into. And then you get into like, how on earth do you start an office, right? Assuming you haven't done it before, you probably don't have a playbook. And there's very, very little information out there on how to start an office, really, especially a successful engineering office.
So sounds like there's step negative one is the why, and step zero is do the math. Like, what's real estate look like? Who are you going to hire? Is this going to be cross-functional? How can you compete? How much does it cost to buy office and real estate? Let's say we've got it. We're like, all right, we don't have a playbook. How many offices had Stripe open before the Seattle office?
I believe it was around the 6 or 7 range, but this was the first office that had engineering in it. And all the other offices were kind of quite small. I mean, the biggest office at the time would have been our Dublin office, which would have been maybe 3 or 4 years old at that point. This is the first kind of office being opened outside of San Francisco and the first office that would have had engineering as a function in the office. Again, Stripe was very familiar with engineers that were not based in our San Francisco office because I believe at the time the engineering org was about 30% remote. Don't necessarily hold me to that number, but it was quite remote friendly. So we already had solved a lot of the problems that you're going to run into. But this was the first one with engineering.
So think it back to, you know, you've decided to open that office, you've got the plans, you want it to be cross-functional and include engineering. If you could time travel back and say, hey, Brian, don't forget about X in your playbook, what are some things that you think you would have liked to learned a little bit faster?
I would have asked them if they had a landing team. So they didn't, right? I think the first thing to do is not do what we did at Seattle, which is hire somebody who's not familiar with the company, how things work. I think it's worked out quite well for me personally in Stripe, and hopefully it's worked out quite well for Stripe. But for every office that we've added engineering to since Seattle, we learned from what didn't work, and we decided to do a landing team and get kind of a cross-section of, you know, engineers if it's an engineering office or non-engineers if it's going to be an office without engineering, and make sure that those individuals are kind of set up for success in that office. So people who are passionate, who are can able to bring company values, and I'm going to be very quite specific about separating company values from company culture, and who are willing to actually do a little bit more than their day job, right? I think spinning up an office involves an immense amount of recruiting and conversations and things that you don't necessarily do in your primary function. So I would go back in time and tell myself during the interview process to ask them if they had a landing team. And honestly, where I am now, I would not go back in time because I maybe wouldn't have joined if that was the case. But I think the positive thing is we've learned an immense amount from that missing component. And I think it's a critical component of spinning up a new office.
Sounds like you talked to some employees from other major companies that have opened second offices before opening yours. What did you learn from those conversations that made things smoother?
Yeah, when I first kind of stepped into the role, you know, not having a landing team and being the first person, I actually didn't have teams to manage. So I spent, you know, my first few weeks speaking to site leads at pretty much every Bay Area company that was willing to speak to me that had an outpost in Seattle. So I spoke with, you know, Facebook, Lyft, Dropbox, Pinterest, Google, Uber, Snapchat, and spoke with all of those site leads and kind of mainly I asked him the question of, if you were doing this again, what would you not do? Right. And I got some quite interesting answers, varied all over the place. And then I took the ones that were consistent across all of those and then endeavored to not do those. Right. So I think one of the consistent things was, don't do engineering only from the very, very beginning. You have to start somewhere. So starting with, you know, engineering is fine, but you should have a plan to have cross-functional, multidisciplinary office, because otherwise you'll end up with a bunch of engineers who have a monoculture, and then when you do want to add something else, you're kind of bolting them on like warts onto this amorphous blob of engineering monoculture, and really you never build a coherent, cohesive, inclusive office if you do that. The other thing is, really hire from a varied set of backgrounds from the beginning, right? I think people have a tendency to hire individuals that come from their own networks, and our own networks are generally very homogeneous, right? The people we've worked with in the past who look, behave, act like ourselves. And the consistent thing I got from pretty much every company I spoke to and every site lead was like, from the very beginning, you need to hire from a varied set of people and a varied set of backgrounds, especially as you move into a new city, a new market, a new country. You need to get that uniqueness, that lack of sameness in from the very, very beginning. It'll make the office a lot better. Many, many other funny things, like you're going to deal with snacks if you're a company that provides snacks, and make sure you get the snack selection down from day one. Otherwise, your engineers and non-engineers are going to be very, very unhappy. So I did not follow that advice, and I have some great stories about the great Snackgate 2017 of the Stripe Seattle office. So,
what's the key snack? What do you have to have? Or is there like a small subset of snacks?
No, we actually have a food philosophy at Stripe around, you know, what kind of food we aim to provide, and so on. The snack that I personally would like is an immense amount of chocolate, but it doesn't actually meet our food philosophy. I don't think there's one. I think it needs to be, you know, crowdsourced from the individuals who are in the office. Otherwise, you will have Snackgate 2017 like we had at Stripe Seattle.
So diversity in backgrounds, diversity in people, diversity in snacks. That's the way to go.
Yeah, okay. Especially if your company provides snacks. If you don't, I think you're already kind of ahead of the game there because you've ruled out one problem.
So it sounds like if you go back in time, snacks, that's one thing. Landing team is another. Maybe the landing team would have brought the snacks learning. Anything else looking back that you would have hoped you could have learned a little more quickly?
I wouldn't say I'd learn more quickly, but I will just, for the listeners who are kind of hearing me opine about this, recruiting is a partner. It's not a service. And from day one, or day zero, if you will, you really have to be partners with recruiting. They basically are the first line for every person who's going to join that office and set the culture for that office. And we actually did do this quite successfully and quite well at Stripe, because recruiting and engineering at Stripe are very much a partnership, and every function with recruiting is a partnership. But I think a lot of companies, especially ones that are more established or follow a more kind of legacy model of building companies, might treat recruiting as a little bit of a service. That would be an absolute mistake.
I go to talent acquisition conferences, and there are lots of talks from recruiting on how to be a better partner for engineers. I have never seen that talk at a technical conference. How can engineering be a better partner for recruiters?
The way I kind of view this is, generally speaking, there's going to be a lot more need from the engineering organization to the recruiting organization. So any company I've worked at, recruiting has been more of a constrained organization because it's treated like a service pretty often. So I kind of look at my relationship recruiting that if I don't proactively provide my recruiters and my partners and my teammates over there everything they need to do the job as quickly as possible for me, I fully expect them to move on to the next manager, the next hiring manager, and do their job. And that is absolutely on me. That is not on the recruiters. If I'm not providing them everything they need to get their job done, then why would they be spending time kind of running against a brick wall trying to solve problems for me when I'm not proactively helping them? That means proactively scheduling time with them, letting them know what I need. It means proactively sourcing myself and finding examples of great candidates that would fill the roles that I need, right? And I think the most leveraged thing you can do very early in an office, if you're one of the first few employees, is get deeply involved in the sourcing, understanding the market, understanding recruiting, and then work with your recruiters and sit down and understand what their job is and the type of questions they're asking, and then give them the answers they need. You know, if you're moving into a new market, chances are very few people in that market know anything about your company. Unless you're like a massive organization, you're going to be new, right? You don't have employer brand awareness in that market, and your recruiters are going to be, you know, answering questions that, you know, that really you should be aware of, and you should be providing the information to the recruiters to help them be successful. So I really do. I kind of lament the fact that at engineering conferences and technical conferences, we don't talk about the fact that we should be better partners to recruiting and not the other way around, because these individuals who have an immensely hard job in recruiting really don't get the support in general, I think, from the industry that they should.
A mental model I've been toying with is that the old DevOps, pre-DevOps, you had operations, you have dev threw the wall over to ops. And I feel like some of that happens right now with engineering and recruiting. I can't think of a fancy term for it, but I feel like what you're describing is the opposite of that. You're partners, you're working together. It's not the other person's problem. It's a shared responsibility.
Absolutely. And especially given the context of what we're talking about is building something, generally speaking, building something from the ground up and scratch. I mean, if you don't want to be involved in that, then chances are you probably shouldn't have been on that landing team, because, you know, you have to be fully invested in finding the first N for whatever N really matters for your function, number of people, because those people, those individuals are the, you know, the torchbearers for your culture from that point forward, right? They're the people that are going to actually hire the next set of people. They're the people whose networks that you are going to start choosing from, because, you know, referrals are going to be a huge part of building an office, right? Especially the first few people you bring in. So by not getting involved in that, it's, to me, it's kind of equivalent to saying that I don't really care about the success of the office, right? I'm maybe moving to this place because the weather is better, right? Or something like that. But I think that's something that those people, those individuals who are making the decision around who should be on a landing team should really understand, you know, are these individuals invested in making this office a success, or are they doing it just because they want to, you know, relocate from San Francisco to Seattle? To be clear, I don't think that's, you know, if you do want to relocate from San Francisco to Seattle, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You need the other thing as well.
It's necessary, but not sufficient. You need to care. When you're building this Seattle office, how do you ensure you have the same culture in Seattle as you do in San Francisco?
I'm smiling while you ask me that question. It's the most common question I get asked from candidates, and I speak to a huge kind of range of candidates across many different functions. But the most common question I get asked is that question, right? How do you ensure you have the same culture in Seattle as San Francisco? And I have the answer down now generally for candidates, but I'll be just kind of a little bit more colloquial now. It's like my question to you is like, why does the culture need to be the same, right? And I don't personally believe it needs to be, right? I think the thing that you need to be the same and consistent across offices are your values. You know, how do decisions get made in your office? How do you decide what needs to be done? How do you ensure that you have autonomy at an office level so that given the same set of context and information for a set of people in office one, that, you know, context and information for a different set of people in office two would probably end up with the same decision, right? And that's really what you need, right? You don't need the same culture, right? And like, what really is culture is a question that a lot of people grapple with. And I think culture is the environment. It is, you know, the values, traditions, it's the beliefs that people have. And that should be unique. I mean, it is objectively unique in across the United States. If we're talking about the US alone, every city is a little bit of a different and unique culture. Why would you want to tamper that or pat that down? So so we actively don't do that at Stripe. We actively do not try to cargo cult or lift a culture from one office to another. What we do is we have a set of operating principles or kind of things we use to guide our decision-making processes so that we know with a strong level of confidence that same information, same context, different people in different places would land at the same outcome. That's what we try to bring from office to office, right? The operating principles, the values. But the culture is appropriately unique in every office.
I love that acceptance test for values is with the same context information, do you end up at the same outcome? Maybe you get there a different way because the culture is different, but it's context and decision and outcome. Did I get that right?
Yeah. And it's also very important if you're talking about building an office that's, you know, time zone or very geographically away from where you are, right? If, you know, Stripe, for example, we have engineers spread across the world. We have engineering offices in, you know, in Singapore and Bangalore and Dublin and other, you know, places around the world, right? And if you think about an office that is so geographically disparate from say San Francisco or Seattle, and we required everybody to come back and check with us on the West Coast of the United States of America before to make a decision, there's like a 2-day turnaround. If you have any kind of feedback to give them where you want something changed, it becomes a 3-day turnaround, right, for them on the other side. So the operating principles and those values for decision making are not only important because they're kind of, they cause consistency across the office, they cause significant increases in velocity, because you know that if people are making, or you should believe and trust that if people are making the decisions using those values and using those operating principles, chances are it's going to be the right, you know, kind of, or not the right, but the same decision that you would have landed at yourself, which may or may not be the correct decision, right? And, you know, you could still, you know, end up with the wrong decision, but as long as you both would have ended up with probably the wrong decision, that's fine, right? So absolutely, it's your operating principles, your values for decision making, same input, same context, different people. Ideally, you get to pretty much the same output, and that does not necessarily mean you have to have the same culture.
It seems like that would be a little bit of a challenge, like there would be some gravity towards the existing culture. How do you ensure that you don't get caught up in that gravity well of the existing other Stripe office culture?
I definitely think, you know, there's things that come into culture that a lot of people talk about. I mentioned the word environment earlier on. You know, it's culture is part of your environment. There is things that are consistent, right, across Stripe in different offices and somewhat of a gravity well, right? All our offices look somewhat the same, you know, somewhat unique local flares or something like that. I'm down in San Francisco right now and I'm based in Seattle. I just walk in, my laptop just connects to Wi-Fi. You know, I sometimes forget that I'm in a different city, in a different office, in a different state. So there's certain things that I think should be consistent around the environment, if you will, the culture, what makes you feel like where you are. I think coming back to you, like the kind of core of your question, like how do you not fell to like this gravity well of like trying to make everything the same? Again, it comes back to intentional. You have to decide that you don't want everything to be the same and you have to make it okay. And by you, I mean, not just the individuals that are in the new office. It's the people who are visiting that office, the leadership of your company who go visit that office and who go there instead of requiring you to come to them. They have to be okay with the fact that and they have to believe in the fact that a separate culture is okay. And we have to celebrate that. And I think one of the things that we do quite effectively at Stripe is actually not really have this centralized model of San Francisco being this kind of hub and spoke. We actually, in Seattle, we adopt behaviors and things from other offices around the world. We do things in Seattle that now the San Francisco office are doing, like the way, you know, we present information, say, in our lunch area or something like that, or the way we communicate or the way we talk about, you know, new hires who are new to the office. San Francisco has adopted some of the things we've done in Seattle. We've adopted some of the things the Singapore office has done in Seattle. You know, the Dublin office is taking things from Singapore. And I think moving your mental mindset away from this hub and spoke model to the values and strengths you get from learning from other locations and cultures and how they can actually strengthen the whole moves you away from this zero-sum game.
So a heuristic that you're achieving a goal of separate cultures, if you see learning that is not one directional, San Francisco teaches everyone else. If you see learning across other offices and you see people visiting other offices, that's a signal to you that you're succeeding at this unique culture?
Yeah, absolutely. We very much kind of view Stripe as kind of not hub and spoke, very multi-directional. You know, again, We'll often do things in Seattle or Dublin or Singapore or Mexico City or one of our other many offices. I feel bad for leaving a lot of them out, but we'll do things there. The first time we'll do a big company initiative will be in that office. It won't be in San Francisco, which is, you know, air quotes, our headquarters, right? Where a lot of, but not all of our executive team and C-suite are based. Actually, intentionally, some of our executive team and C-suite team are based in Seattle. So you have this kind of multi-directional learning, I'll call it cultural sharing, that happens kind of from every which way to improve the overall strength of the company. You know, it's kind of just getting better across the board on everything by learning from other people, right? That's probably why you want to have a different office. If you didn't want to gain something unique from the other office, you probably could have just outsourced. It would have been cheaper.
So the goal is, we have these other offices, why not learn from them instead of just having places to house extra humans? I like that idea. One of the decisions you've made that I haven't heard much about other people choosing is having teams that span multiple offices and making that a deliberate decision. Why have you decided to have teams across offices?
So let me be quite specific. We don't have individual teams. So a group of individuals reporting to a manager at most will be based in one office plus remotes. So we actually have a set of guidelines around this. Groups of teams. So let's say a manager of managers. So somebody who may have, you know, four or five different teams reporting to them. We quite intentionally, you know, can have those teams spread across the world, right? Many of the reasons why is people are based certain places, especially when you're spinning up a new office. A lot of the time you do that because of, you know, constraints around headcount or growth or things in one location. You want to get specialized talent in another location, but that doesn't necessarily mean that team or that group of teams is not going to work very closely with another group of team or report into a manager somewhere else, right? So we do have guidelines that says that an individual team, and I define it, an individual team as, you know, individual contributors, software engineers who report to the same manager will exist in at most one office, but groups of teams can be spread across other offices. So, you know, I recently transitioned to a new role at Stripe in our reliability org as the head of reliability. Prior to this, I led a group called Traffic, which is made up of four or five different teams. They were all co-located in Seattle. That was actually quite unique. Most of my peers who were, you know, either in Seattle or San Francisco or other offices would have had teams that were spread across Seattle, San Francisco, Dublin, Singapore, things like that. So the smallest unit in a given office is a manager with individual contributors plus, and I'll say plus remote because any team can have remote engineers on it, but the smallest unit being an actual team with a manager. Now, kind of related to that, sometimes you want to move a mission from one place to another, right? In that case, you can't just say, everybody up, pack all your bags, put them in a container, move to your treehouse or coffee shop in Seattle, right? So we have guidelines at Stripe. We don't really have policies, right? And the guidelines specifically account for those scenarios, right? We allow teams to be split across offices for up to 12 months while you're kind of growing a new mission that's directly related to an existing mission, right? With the goal to eventually hire a manager in the local office and, you know, bifurcate the team, right? We also tend to at Stripe really prefer to grow teams larger rather than have lots and lots of small teams. So we prefer to add scope to a team and then bifurcate the team when it gets to a certain size rather than have many, many small teams. So this also lends itself to, for a period of time while a team is growing, splitting across two offices and then eventually bifurcating into two unique teams across offices.
So instead of a model where you might hire three people, put them on a new team, and give them a mission, you might prefer to grow a team that already had seven to maybe 10 or something that felt a little big, and then split it at some middle point.
Exactly. Yeah, I think there's fixed cost to having a team, right? Especially a team of three. If you have, depending on how you run your engineering process, I'll just assume you run sprints. For example, a team of three running sprints with daily stand-ups with an on-call rotation, the engineers there are not going to be very happy because they're not going to spend much of their time actually writing code or engineering. They're going to spend a lot of their time doing the fixed cost of a team, right? So generally, I think, you know, for me personally, something quite sacred is a well-gelled, well-executing group of individuals on a team. And I think you can add additional scope to a group of individuals and then add more individuals to a team that is really well executing and knows how to work well to each other. And they can be spread across offices and they will continue to be better than, this is my personal opinion, I feel they will continue to be better than an individual group of three new people somewhere else with a lot of fixed cost. And then once you get to this critical mass, and that critical mass depends on what your idealized, you know, manager, individual contributor ratio is in your company. But once you get to that like 10, 11, 12 size, you bifurcate, you split into maybe two teams of six or a five and a seven. And, you know, the new team, the, we call this the build and bud model at Stripe, kind of like, you know, the bud of a plant. You eventually, once it gets strong enough, you can break it off, you can plant it in the ground, it'll grow its own roots and it'll be very, very successful on its own. But if you break it off when it's very, very young and just stick it in the ground when it's really, really small, it's going to die. And we call this build and bud, where you build the scope and the responsibility and size of a team, and then you bud off the other team. So that's the way we think about it. It's the way I personally think about it as well.
I love that metaphor, build and bud. We're in the same, we're looking at hiring our first set of we have three engineers right now, including two founders. So we're trying to figure out, how do we build this as a team? Do we hire two people, put them on another team? And build and bud would be, no, we have one team until we want to build it too big and scope too big, and then we split it.
Yeah. And the other thing to be aware of here is there can be fixed cost to that as well, right? There's the fixed cost of, if you do have an on-call rotation or something like that, you probably have people who really are working on, say, one work stream, but they now need to become more familiar with, you know, the other work streams, so that they're on call, you can share that load. And some people view that as a cost, right? I view that as kind of like building this inclusive environment where more people understand the software and the systems that you actually have. And I think it's actually a quite positive thing to do that and to share the load. Having kind of shared context and a larger team with multiple work streams does not necessarily mean that everybody needs to know and work on everything, right? Like, you can create, you know, the concept, you know, I'm from Seattle, there's lots of orcas up there. Well, I'm from Ireland, I live in Seattle, and lots of orcas up there. So like the term pod jumps into my mind a lot. Like, you can create pods in a team, right? You can still have shared on-call, you can have shared sprint planning, and then you can have unique pods or streams of work where maybe three people are working on a pod in a particular stream of work for some period of time, and then you rotate onto something else, and it builds expertise, shares knowledge, it keeps the team cohesive. And again, as I mentioned, something quite sacred to me is well-gelled, well-executing teams. I think it's, you know, the difference between a team that's forming and a team that's really, really executing well, performing well, is just like night and day. You know, I mean, there's the mythical, you know, a 10x engineer. I'm quite skeptical of that, but I think, you know, a firm believer in like a team, a group of individuals who can work together significantly 10x, even more than 10x more effectively than a group of individuals who are not working effectively together. If anything, they're definitely less than the sum of the individual parts if you're not working together.
So it sounds like we can have 100x teams, but maybe not 10x engineers.
Yeah, I'd probably get in trouble for saying that, but yeah, that's my own my own personal belief. Yeah,
don't worry, no one's listening. It's
just the two of us. Yeah.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help engineering teams hire better fit developers faster. We do that by finding hidden gems in their hiring pool. What's a hidden gem? Take one of our customers. They're hiring for a DevOps engineer and struggling to find a great fit. According to LinkedIn's recent research, DevOps is the hardest position to hire for. So this experience is pretty common. So our customer kicks off with us. They've been struggling to hire this DevOps role. And then we get started and a candidate comes in. Let's call him Matt. Matt's last title was Test Automation Engineer. Not an ideal fit for DevOps role. Usually Matt does not make it past the resume phase. Instead, with Woven, he got a chance to spend an hour showing what he can do, actually doing DevOps work, writing scripts, understanding architecture. After seeing the results from his work simulation, our customer interviewed Matt, loved him. He went on site, they loved him, and he's killing it. Here's what the manager had to say after he hired Matt. Without Woven, we would have missed out on Matt. We wouldn't have gained such a high caliber teammate. He had a test automation title as last job, and now he's crushing the DevOps role. It's day three, and he's already automated parts of our infrastructure on day three. If you want to see how we can help you find a great hire like Matt, we'll build you a tailored demo link for you to explore. Go to woventeams.com/demo to get started. That's woventeams.com/demo. So switching gears from the team level to the individual level. So there are folks that are on our teams, maybe, or we encounter that might have invisible illnesses. So chronic pain, mental illness. As leaders, how should we accommodate folks like this? And how should that awareness change the way we act?
So I, again, very, very familiar to myself. I actually personally have suffered from chronic pain for many, many years. I think I've had one day of my own life without pain since July 17th, 2009. Now it's kind of getting hard to remember. So I think about this quite a lot because I can't not. It is constant. It is, you know, chronic. I think the way this has changed me as an individual is pretty all-encompassing, right? The way I approach every situation and every interaction is kind of, this is a new interaction. I personally do not know what this individual is going through at this moment, be it, you know, emotional, you know, chronic pain, you know, infertility, depression, you know, you just don't know what somebody is going through at any given moment in time, right? So I think, you know, from that, I view every interaction with an individual, even the same interaction, as somewhat of a new interaction, right? If I talk to you in the morning, and I talk to you in the evening, and I get two different people, that's okay, right? Just because I had a conversation with you this morning, and you were one way, and you had a conversation this afternoon, and you were a different way, I don't know what's going on for you, right? And I think it's perfectly fine in terms of how I interact with people in the conversation themselves. Assume best intent, right? Invisible ailments and in particular chronic pain can really, you know, affect people in very short periods of time and change the way they think and behave. And just be kind of somewhat forgiving and somewhat open to the fact that you don't know what the individual is going through at that particular time, right? So if you're worried or concerned about an interaction, a great time to talk about that is not in the moment. It's later on, right? And ask them how they're doing, ask them how they're feeling, ask them if, you know, say what you've observed, that their behavior has changed in some way and that you're concerned, and ask how it works. And, you know, often when I talk to people about this, you know, the next question I'm going to preempt is, but that takes a lot of time. And it's like, it's investing in people and it's investing in teams. And again, I'm a firm believer in well executing teams that understand each other and understand how to interact with each other and are well gelled are way more effective than teams that are not. And I think trusting that people have best intent is really, really powerful there.
So what I heard is, we need to be okay, try to be okay with people being different in different interactions because we don't know what else might be going on. If we do encounter something that we, you know, maybe doesn't feel exactly on or maybe a little off, that's a conversation that's best had later. And that is worth the time if we're asking how someone's feeling and expressing concern.
Yep. And the other thing I'll add to that, don't ever expect anybody to, or don't ever kind of believe that they have to answer you, right? For a lot of people, these things are quite private. They don't feel safe having that conversation in public. Maybe they've been retaliated against in the past, right? Maybe they're embarrassed. Maybe it's a challenging, very personal thing, right? For me personally, I'm very open with sharing this because I struggled with this quite a lot through different companies, and it affected me in terms of my job performance and so on. And when I actually started, you know, having conversations with managers and peers and colleagues, which is a big leap, it was very hard for me to do, to trust that you can have these conversations and be vulnerable. Not once has it ever gone a negative way for me. It has always gone quite positive, and I've always felt supported. And if anything, my career and my ability to be an effective, you know, kind of employee for any company has got significantly better because I talk about it. But that's me, right? And other people from different backgrounds, from different demographics, from different, you know, cultural backgrounds may not feel comfortable doing that, right? And don't expect that just because you ask, somebody has to answer.
That's great advice. I think I've mostly had good responses to me sharing. So I'm autistic and I've had really good responses, but I think that's also a function of where I am. Like, I think it's a lot easier. I have more power in a lot of situations, to put it like really simply. You shared a book that you said has had an impact on you called Invisible Women, Data Bias in a World Designed for Men. Could you tell us a little bit about that book and what you learned from it?
Yeah, I read a lot. It seems to be a common trope for people who are based, who work at Stripe. So I've read a lot of books this year, but that particular book really resonated and landed with me a lot because it opened my eyes quite a bit to really how much bias there is in things that I would have just assumed there was none, right? It kind of created this change in the way I think about every interaction and every situation, right? I'll give you a little anecdote as well that was not in the book, but it's about myself, about a change that happened to me individually. I'll give that later. But the book talks about, you know, how everything from, you know, financial situations to the way bus routes work to the first, you know, set of streets they plow in Norway or one of the Scandinavian countries, you know, how it's so just, you know, unobviously, so unconsciously biased for a given set of individuals, right? And generally speaking, those individuals are men. And then it goes, the reason I actually really enjoyed the book is it is immensely well researched. Being in engineering, I love data, I love stats. I think that, you know, the book probably took me probably 8 hours to read or something like that. And I probably spent about 3 weeks reading nothing but the linked off articles and appendices and the bibliography and like every kind of paper I could around this particular thing and really nerding out on the data and the stats and realizing how unconsciously we've really biased pretty much society in one particular dimension. And, you know, regardless of your own personal feelings about feminism or, you know, gender differences or biases or things like that, the book is just immensely well written. It is eye-opening, it is factual, and it has frankly changed my view of the world, right? And the physical world and the software world, right? And I'll go back to my personal anecdote now. So I grew up in Ireland. You know, when you walk off a footpath, I believe it's called a sidewalk here in America, you have this curb. I believe the curb is the same thing, right? And never in my entire life did I think anything about curbs, right? I just step off them, cross the road, step onto the next one. I became a parent, and I was just walking my daughter in her stroller and just like going off the curb, and she's asleep, and I'd just been walking around for ages to try and get her asleep, and just like, go off the curb. She wakes up and then she's crying for so long. And I just turned to my friend and I said to her, I was like, oh, why don't they put ramps on curbs? This is like so annoying. And she's like, yeah, can you imagine how it feels for people in wheelchairs? Right. And it was just really, that moment itself was really eye-opening for me as well. In that, like, here's something as, you know, mundane as a curb on a footpath or sidewalk, depending on where in the world you are, and you step off it. And, you know, never think about it. And then for me, I just like shifted to be a parent, and it completely shifted my relationship with this inanimate and mundane object. And then I mentioned something to my friend and they're like, yeah, but there's an entire demographic of individuals for which this is actually a mobility issue, right? And this is not about a curb, right? It's just about the fact that, you know, I consider myself to think quite broadly and think about many different dimensions of problems. And I like to believe that, you know, I think rigorously and deeply about challenges and problems. But a curb had me very, very biased, right? I'm very, very stuck in one particular mindset. And I think this book was just full of so many examples of that were data-based, research-based. And, you know, as engineers, I think we love data and we love research. So, that's why that book in particular for me so far this year has been quite great.
My guest today has been Brian Delahunty. Brian, thank you for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Brian for sharing his experience with us. Here are a couple of takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, opening a second site requires asking a lot of questions and being intentional. There are a lot of things that come before opening the doors of your second office. Some of the questions Brian asks, is it okay to open just an engineering office? Brian thinks no. He thinks the culture of an engineering-only office becomes a challenge when you want to add a second function. So he recommends starting with multiple functions or at least knowing what you're giving up. Brian also recommends asking the question, why do we have this office? And driving to a serious answer beyond, well, there's people here. How will this office work 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years from now? What analysis did we do before choosing this site? We should think about long-term growth of this market. What's the depth of this market? Which functions will go into this office? Again, hopefully not just engineering. What are our motivations for doing this? And why do we think it's important to open the second office? Because it's hard. His maybe top tip is to have a landing team to help you integrate with the company when you're employee zero in a new city. A landing team is a group of volunteers from the previous office that agree to move to a city permanently or at least short term. These need to be folks that are ambassadors of our culture. They're going to seed culture. So selection of that landing team is very important. Brand does not recommend just taking the folks that happen to want to move there. They need to be really great cultural representatives. Now on culture, number two is you don't need the same culture in every office. Brian's most common question is, how do you keep the culture the same? And his answer is, I don't. Stripe's Seattle office has a very different culture from Stripe's San Francisco office, and that's a good thing. What does need to be consistent is operating principles, values. Stripe's goal is two different offices that are given the same information, same context, and same problem should come to the same conclusion, the same decisions. They focus on operating principles and are encouraging of different cultures in different offices. These operating principles increase decision velocity because each office can be independent and not have to wait for an overseas office to approve a thing. If you've got time zones, this could make even small decisions take an entire day or more. It's very easy to feel the gravity of the existing culture, and that's okay. You can borrow from the other offices. What Stripe focuses on is not a hub and spoke model. They focus on no actual HQ. Every site is equal, more of a distributed network model. That allows them to bring learning from other offices back to HQ rather than HQ being responsible for all the learning and pushing it out. That makes each office more valuable and accelerates learning. Number three, a large part of management success is being open to others' circumstances. Brian has personally suffered chronic pain for many years and has had a profound impact on his professional life. There are disabilities that we can see with our eyes, and then there are even more that we can't. Depression, anxiety, things happening in someone's personal lives. What Brian tries to do is when he has a reaction with a colleague, instead of reacting to their emotions, their situation, he reminds himself that I do not know what this person is going through at this given moment. Every interaction is a new one because the context could be changing for them. We have to be, as leaders, we have to be okay with people being different in different interactions because their personal context might have changed. When someone does something that may feel off, the best time to ask about it is usually not right then. It's usually later, and that's what Brian tries to do. We shouldn't expect someone to share. It's okay for them to keep it private. But our goal is to provide a safe place to share if it would be helpful and if they would like to. Thanks again to Brian for coming on the show. Now, I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. This will help others find our community. Until next week, keep on scaling.